The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, for more than a decade, glass artists at the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center in southern Vermont have been challenged and inspired by the creativity of children. We'll speak with an artist who is bringing drawings to life. And we'll catch up with an apple researcher in Western Massachusetts. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Since 2011, glass artists at the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center in southern Vermont have been challenged and inspired by the creativity of children. Glasstastic invites kids of all ages to dream up imaginary creatures. Their drawings are then rendered into glass sculptures. One of the glass artists, Robert Dugrenier, has participated in Glasstastic for 7 years. Robert is the owner of the Robert Dugrenier Glass Art Gallery in Townsend, Vermont. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with him about the glass sculpture-making process.
Their imagination is just amazing and quite challenging to make in glass.
And what are the opportunities that are given to them to maybe learn about glass making?
So a few of the designs that the particular artists choose, I know I have had two of the creators come to the studio when we're making the pieces, and they enjoyed that immensely. And they would comment and, no, that's not right. Make it a little curvier. So it was just, they had this amazing vision. And I think helping look at the process of glass blowing, one, is really fascinating. And two, they were just in awe. It was incredible. It was a bit of inspiration, I think, potentially for, you know, their future creative selves. So if we can inspire one kid at an early age to have a passion and take up a career, it's brilliant.
Have you learned anything in this process from the children, and have any of the designs maybe challenge you that you haven't been challenged before in any of the other pieces that you've made?
Yeah, every single design that comes through is a huge challenge because, you know, they're fantasy creatures, and glass blowing has a lot of restrictions and techniques and challenges. I mean, you're working with a molten moving material, and to try to control it and adapt it and still get the spirit of the creatures that the kids are creating is a huge challenge. And it gets us outside of our box. So I think that that's a wonderful thing because there are forms and shapes and ideas that we had never dreamed of doing. And that exposes to our childness self. And you forget how many things that, you know, the material dictates what you can do. So when I usually sit down to design something, I know how I can make it already. So when I sit down to make one of these things, I have no idea. And it usually takes two or three creatures, you know, of one design to get it really to have the character that the child's envisioning.
And with the many drawings that are submitted, what makes you pick one maybe over the other to bring to life?
One just speaks to you, or they usually ask us to do two or three because we're looking through, you know, four or five binding notebooks of drawings, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of drawings. And, you know, one will just speak to you. I know the first year I chose a dragon, which had all these parts and bits and fire coming out of the mouth, which was pretty much impossible to do with glass blowing. So I did kind of learn my lesson the first year. I did achieve something. It wasn't as great or that I was as proud of, but the child loved it. But that definitely, when I'm looking at the drawings, I'm also thinking about, really, is it possible? How big of a challenge is this going to be? So there's a little bit of influence there, just knowing the techniques that we use in glassmaking.
I would love for you maybe to describe some of the techniques that you do use in glassmaking.
Great. So we're working, there's many different ways to blow glass, or to make glass. The techniques that some of us are using is called offhand blowing. So you have a a furnace of molten glass, and you're gathering glass on rods out of it, out of the furnace, and you're manipulating it with various tools, and you're reheating it, you're adding color, you're adding bits, and it's something that the glass has to be above 960 degrees the whole time you're making it. If it cools below that, the chances of the glass fracturing are huge, or falling off one of the pipes that you have. So it's a challenge, and you can't like put it away and then bring it out again and work on it. So it can take anywhere from a half an hour to 2 hours to perfect the piece that you're working on. And then once it has the feeling and character that we're trying to achieve from the child's drawing, it goes into what's called an annealing oven, and that's held at 960 degrees and slowly cools down over 18 hours. So the inside and the outside of the glass is the same temperature every degree it goes down. And that anneals the glass. It aligns all the molecules up properly, and there's no stress in it, so it doesn't crack. If we just left it out to air cool, it would explode within like 5 or 10 minutes. There are other glass workers that use a lamp glass, which is they're melting the glass with a torch on a bench. And there's various glasses that you can use. And one is borosilicate glass, which is the glass like Pyrex that our coffee pots are made. And you can put it on a hot stove and it's not going to crack. So that you can work and cool and add bits. You can get a lot finer detail with a fine torch and fine colors, much finer than you can with the offhand glass blowing. There's also another type of glass, which is a soda lime glass that the flame workers use also, which is softer. It's a little more challenging than the Pyrex, but it also creates a very similar effect and incredibly realistic. I mean, some of the artists that are in the show, their own personal work, one guy does these amazing insects, tiny little legs. I mean, they're just absolutely exquisite, all made out of glass. And so there's inspirations. I'm sure they're looking at the drawings and they're looking at something that might be a little more delicate and fine detailed than some of the offhand glass blowers would use.
And I would love for you to take me throughout your process and the steps that you take once you've chosen a drawing of an imaginary creature, and then therefore creating this glass sculpture.
It's not an exact duplicate, but you're trying to get the feeling of the creature. And what's wonderful is not only are they drawing, they're telling the story of who the creature is and what he does. I remember one year I did, it was Squidward, I think it was one of the Nickelodeon characters, and he lived under sea, and they told us what he ate. And so inspiration from the story that they achieved with the drawing really just adds another dimension. And when they're displayed with the drawing and with the imaginary character's description, and then of course the final piece. And I think what's beautiful and wonderful about the Butterbur Museum show that they've put together is that the child receives the award, the glass piece. So they're having a sculpture and probably the first piece of art that they didn't make that they've collected, which I think is just, again, I think a really powerful tool to get, you know, children into the creative field.
And how long does it take to make a glass sculpture, and what kind of glass do you use specifically?
So normally, I think probably the shortest amount of time was a half hour. The longest amount of time I've worked on one was 2 hours. And I'm working with a soda lime glass, and it's specially formulated for offhand glass blowers. We're able to reheat it, and it's got a beautiful clarity to it, but also is compatible with really a whole rainbow of colors. And the colors can be added in bits in various techniques to really achieve the color that most of the drawings have. I don't think I've ever seen a drawing that was like a crystal man that was meant to all be just clear glass. It's always, always adorned beautiful colors, which, again, is just, again, that imagination that the kids have is just really inspiring.
What can make a imaginary creature drawing particularly hard to bring to life? What characteristics that is therefore maybe more difficult to transfer over into this 3D glass sculpture?
So I think if there was a monster that had 28 legs, you put one leg on at a time, by the time you get the 28th leg on, all the other ones have melted. So use the appendages or something that is really difficult to do on the offhand blowing. You know, two or three legs are fine. We leave that to the flame workers that can add 26 legs, because they don't have to keep them all equally heated at once. They can add one, let it cool, add another one, let it cool, add another one, especially using the borosilicate glass, the Pyrex glass.
And you kind of alluded to this before in the previous questions that I've asked, but I would love to know where you learned how to make art with glass and what inspired you.
So, I was inspired at 12 years old up at the Montreal Expo looking at live glassblowing demos, and really realized that glass is in every part of our lives, from windows to lenses to telescopes to drinking glasses to it's there. And I never realized it until I saw glass being manipulated in so many different ways and so many different methods. And that was a huge inspiration. And so really I learned the art of glass blowing. I started at Philadelphia College of Art, and from there I went to school in London at Hornsey College of Art and did a postgraduate degree at Middlesex Polytechnic. And then I did a MFA degree at Illinois State University out in Illinois. And so really 12 years of really working with the material in an experimental way, because I didn't have to make money in school, and I was able to learn casting and torch working and just every aspect of glass that is out there. One thing that's a little bit childish but I think fascinating is I make these glass shells that live hermit crabs live in. It happened one day on a beach in Abaco. A hermit crab crawled across my blanket, and it was living in the broken neck of a Coke bottle. And I said to myself, oh, my God, I can make a better home than a broken neck of a Coke bottle, and came home and started experimenting. And 6 months later, successfully, I had a shell that a hermit crab moved into. And I thought, what a shame. We go to the beach, we collect all these beautiful shells and stick them in our bathroom, but they're the secondary home for hermit crabs. And so I did an exhibit in New York City, and sort of an environmentally conscious one, and I didn't realize how many people had pet hermit crabs, and everyone wanted to buy one of these glass shells. And since 1995, I've been making them, and I have them in installations in aquariums really all around the world. And it's a great learning tool to be able to see what the hermit crab looks like inside the shell. And they're the perfect critic. So if they don't like the shell, if it's too heavy, if it's not the right shape, they won't live in it. So they're my greatest critic. And that, again, gives that sort of childish play and imagination that I'm glad I've carried into adulthood.
Yeah, that's lovely. I love that. Do you have, looking back at Glasstastic in the 7 years that you've spent contributing, have a favorite imaginary creature that you've brought to life or maybe the most proud of?
Wow, that's a really hard one. They've all been a huge challenge, and I distinctly remember all of them. One that I really like to make, and it was interesting because, again, it was the story about the character, and it was, I'm forgetting the child's name. The last name was Burns, and I just love that she drew this character that was a candlestick, and her last name was Burns. And, of course, I'm getting burnt all the time in the glass shop, so it was like this totally spoke to me. And so that was one of the drawings that we selected. The museum had said, oh, would you be interested in having the girl that designed the piece come to the studio and watch you make it? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, that would be fantastic. That was one of the first years I had kids come to the studio and make it. And they arrived, and her dad was with her, who was Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And it was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. So you just never know who's going to show up at your door. And that was something that I thought was quite amusing.
And then And what is the aspect of Glasstastic that you enjoy the most as a glass artist?
I think meeting the children and looking at their excitement, because a lot of them didn't go and visit the studios, but how proud they are and their families that they have a piece of glass that they designed that's actually in a museum show. I think that was that looking at the excitement on everyone's faces, you know, it's just, you know, it's a dream for any artist to get into a museum, never mind a kid from 5 to 12 years old. I'm not sure that the age range, but I think that the excitement of having a piece exhibited that the world is coming to look at and admire.
Robert Dugrenier is a glass artist and owner of Robert Dugrenier Glass Art Gallery in Townsend, Vermont. Glasstastic at Brattleboro Museum and Art Center is taking submissions from children until December 16th. Their drawings will be brought to life for the Glasstastic 2025 exhibition that opens on March 22nd at BMAC. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. The Battle of Saratoga in 1777 is known as the turning point of the American Revolution. Almost 250 years later, residents and students in the small New York community of Schuylerville celebrated the Continental Army's victory. The Best of Our Knowledge's Aaron Cello Levine has the story.
October 17th marks Surrender Day in the Saratoga County Village. British General John Burgoyne led his troops to surrender against the Continental Army in 1777. It ended the British attempt to control the Hudson River Valley, and the victory secured French support of the colonies.
So it was a day like this in 1777. The British had a horrible stay in Saratoga. It was a week of wet. They were cold, they were miserable, they didn't have enough supplies, so they were hungry. They described horses going around looking like living skeletons. And then today is similar because on October 17, 1777, it was a bright sunny day.
Town of Saratoga historian Sean Kelleher is wearing a blue and white cotton coat and tricorn hat, dressed as American General Horatio Gates. He's standing on the banks of Fort Hardy Park, and the morning fog is still lifting off the Hudson behind him.
It's very special because this is how we build stewards for our community. It's real. The Battles of Saratoga is considered the turning point of the American Revolution. It's one of the most significant battles in world history. But as Americans, what makes it really important is that the Declaration of Independence was just words on a piece of paper until it was made a great fact here at Saratoga, where the first time a complete British army surrendered. So it's great that we're celebrating this in this community, and our plans are to just improve the celebrations, especially as we head towards our 250th anniversary.
The Capital Region and the Northeast at large are planning for an increase in heritage tourism as the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution approaches. The nearby Saratoga National Historical Park drew more than 100,000 visitors in 2023, and county leaders continue to fund 250th anniversary initiatives. Groups of students are walking from the Schuylerville Central School just down the road. Saratoga County historian Lauren Roberts wants to expand today's program to more schools.
It's an experience. It's being on the ground where history happened. It's out of the classroom. It's looking at the Hudson River behind you and knowing that a really important world event happened here. So if you can impress upon kids at a young age, it's here because people that came before them have preserved it, and that's what we want to impress upon them, that now it's our turn and the legacy continues, right? Depending on how they feel and how they treat their history, if they're proud of where they're from and what happened here, if they continue to tell the stories and learn more about it, then it helps history going forward.
The program includes speeches from local officials and students, 13 apple cider toasts, a reenactment of the surrender.
He returned my sword, but he's keeping my army!
And a live cannon.
Fire!
It's one of teacher Peter Carner's favorite days of the year. He's a history buff.
I was going to say the kids love the canon, obviously. But for these guys, and seeing the people reenact in their attire, having the kids come in with the muskets really puts it into perspective and puts it real for them. So it's not just something they read about in books. They're seeing it and talking to the people. So that makes it real life. It's very easy to teach fourth grade history in Schuylerville.
His students have a harder time picking their favorite part of the morning.
Shooting the cannons and singing.
Shooting the cannons.
Yeah, I like for me it was
either drumming or the cannons.
For the best of our knowledge, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Autumn is the season for apples in the Northeast. In Massachusetts, one researcher is looking for more than just a crisp taste. As WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief James Polyoligopoulos reports, the red, green, and gold fruits of labor tend to thrive in the Bay State.
Since Labor Day, it's been one of the busiest times of the year for fruit scientists and specialists like John Clements. Plugging away in the lab at the University of Massachusetts Cold Spring Orchard, tucked away in Belchertown near the Quabbin Reservoir, his days include adding troves of data to an apple maturity report, a lengthy assessment keeping tabs on different varieties and how they're faring. Letting WAMC take a peek of the operation in late September, he was in the midst of testing a half dozen Harrelsons. Slicing them up, he hits them with an iodine solution to test their starchiness. He's also able to see a disorder emerging in the variety.
I cut these in half right down the equator. This is a disorder called water core that is not itself not terrible.
If anything, he says, it's a sign of how ripe this kind of apple is at this stage of the year. For almost 25 years, Clements has been working with the university's Extension Unit. Part of the UMass Amherst Center for Agriculture, Food, and the Environment, the university says it is the Massachusetts partner in the National Cooperative Extension System and addresses public concerns of high priority for the Commonwealth. That includes providing training, educational opportunities, and spreading research amongst growers. For Clements, the Extension fruit team leader, that often means traveling across the state to meet and advise with orchard owners, spreading word of new trends while hearing concerns and answering questions. While the state is known for its cranberry bogs and nurseries, its apple crop is close to the core, too. Clements estimates his customer base is about 100 apple farmers, combining for roughly 3,000 acres in Massachusetts, a state that, while small compared to other agricultural hubs, is more than ideal for the crop.
I like to say that we are in the sweet spot for growing apples. I mean, we may be affected by climate change a little bit, but we can grow almost any apple variety here. Whereas you go farther north, you know, where they have like up in Canada, where they have a shorter growing season, you go farther south, they have, you know, the hot weather. Apples don't really like hot weather. They're more of a real temperate. So we're in a real sweet spot.
That sweet spot includes the slice of Hampshire County Clements and a handful of other researchers make use of. The property spans about 50 acres, including space devoted to peaches and other fruits. But this time of the year, the name of the game is apples, now ripe and, in many cases, falling to the ground. The facility came to be in the early 1960s after UMass Amherst moved to convert its previous research orchard into dorms. Clements says due to the significance of the orchard, the Massachusetts Fruit Growers Association pitched in to purchase the then Hannafin Farm and donate the property. Nowadays, Cold Spring Orchard is open throughout the week for those wanting to pick fruit themselves or buy some at their shop. The orchard's largely self-sustaining, Clements says, with McIntosh, Gala, and Cortland's among the varieties available. The orchard's also the scene of experiments.
Probably during a growing season, between the entomologists, the horticulturists, the pathologists, we had 6, 7, 8 different experiments. And this, they can change from year to year. Often it's just looking at, you know, we can look at management tactics. Sometimes it's, you know, called IPM, integrated pest management, whether it's spraying or using traps, monitoring the pests, We do all that. I have a bunch of weather stations in this orchard that are kind of monitoring the microclimates.
More than 100 varieties of apples are growing on the property, many in the back, off limits to the public, including a sort of researcher's playground, Clements explains as he gives me a tour, driving between the rows of crossbreeds, products of testing, and special types of apples undergoing experiments. One particular variety, Modi apples, grow in this spot, slender and dark red. Clements can't recall how they came to be at Cold Spring, but we take a bite anyway.
These are the only Modi trees in Massachusetts. There's an outfit in California that has licensed this. These were from Italy. The group that bred this apple licensed this outfit in California to grow these, and they won't let anybody have them. It's unfortunate because I think it's a nice apple. We could, you know, it grows well for us. It's productive every year.
Nearby, and somewhat similar in shape and color, are the Pizzazz apples, a club variety that can't be grown in the rest of Massachusetts.
You don't have to eat the whole thing. Just take one bite. Tell me what you think. Be honest, too.
That's not bad. Mm-hmm. That's well balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere in the rows of apple trees are varieties tied to the Midwest Apple Improvement Association, one of several groups trying to introduce new varieties for smaller growers, including pick-your-own growers. Clements estimates there's about 15 or 20 different varieties in that vein. By and large, he says the apple industry in New England itself is generally shrinking. Stiff competition in the wholesale business poses challenges, and on top of taking years, creating new orchards is a costly affair, an estimated $20,000 to $25,000 an acre at least. But Clements says those who are in are in it for the long haul. Helping them out through UMass is its own reward.
So over the course of 25 years, you get to know them pretty well, and that's really the rewarding part of my job. In addition to this kind of research, I also like this, but you know, working with the growers, helping them solve problems, become more sustainable, hopefully more profitable. Many of them are very good business people, and I even hesitate to call them small businesses because some of these orchards are become quite big, and you know, they're small businesses, yes, but multi-million-dollar small businesses, if you can imagine. Trust me.
Reporting from Belchertown, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs, on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment. Visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1777. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.